It's been great to be with you here this weekend, and on this final presentation, I want to focus on ancient Babylon. The title of the presentation is Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon, Sumer, and the Quest for Power. And what I want to do in this presentation is go with you not only back to ancient Sumer and Babylon, but then to tie that in with what has been happening there recently. Because just as we have prophecies being fulfilled in the past, there are prophecies in Scripture that still also speak about today. And it's interesting to see how that interplays with each other. Right now we have a special exhibit at Southern Adventist University, and if you're ever in Tennessee and come by the Chattanooga area and visit our university, we have a special exhibit focusing on ancient seals of the biblical world. We have a state-of-the-art museum there at Southern, and from time to time we do special exhibits that come in from different places, and this one was put together by my colleague Dr. Martin Klingbeil, and it focuses on seals and seal impressions, and what this has in it is part of the Yale Babylonian collection. Yale University has one of the largest collections of artifacts from ancient Mesopotamia, 45,000 artifacts. Our museum is very small in comparison in terms of its holdings. But we were able to get some of the finest pieces from Yale University, and we have them on display at Southern, including the only actual seal of an ancient Judean king. The seal of Ushna, the servant of Ahaz. Ahaz was the father of Hezekiah, the person we preached about in the divine service, and Ahaz was his father. So we have his seal there on display. It's beautiful. It's bright orange carnelian. It's tiny. It's about the size of your pinky fingernail. And it shows serpents on it. It's just wonderful. So if you're ever in the area, it's going to be up for another year and a half. And we have a permanent exhibit as well. But today we want to focus on this particular topic. You know, the Word of God is a light, the lamp unto our feet and a light unto our paths. And the Word of God, as we go through this presentation and have gone through this weekend, continues to give us new insights as we find new insights in history concerning its prophecy. Sorry, going wrong direction. There we go. For most of our lives, and as I see the children coming in, for definitely most of their lives, we've been hearing about Iraq a lot in the news, haven't we? And that hasn't changed in recent years. I have students at Southern Adventist University that have served in our armed forces and have come back from Iraq and Afghanistan. And they've shared with me their pictures. They've shared with me their stories. They've shared with me their experiences. It was a war that devastating to the country. There are millions of Iraqis today that are refugees in other countries as a result of this, and we are still also, I think, suffering the consequences in our country as our men and women have come back home. And the effects of war are devastating. My grandfather always said this, having gone through two world wars. He said, Michael, he said, in war, everybody suffers. And while there may be a right and while there may be a wrong, there are always atrocities on both sides. And there's suffering as a result. One of our faculty members served there as a chaplain, and when he came back, he suffered psychologically for a number of years from what took place there. And I know that our men and women who have cervical time. When Barack Obama, our president, announced that he was going to bring back most of the troops and did so, and after 2011, they started leaving Iraq in 2010. Many people were very, very happy that it was finally over. And yet we have seen that the unrest continues, doesn't it, today? As we see the spread of ISIS or ISIL as it moves across Syria and Iraq, we have a new threat and a new situation. And sometimes I remember actually some years ago, I don't know if you know this, but Many of you know this name now because we've just gone through a whole process of an election, but many of you know the name Ted Cruz, of course, right? And I don't know if any of you know this, but his wife is an Adventist or maybe a former Adventist. And in 2003, when we first went into Iraq, she was invited to come and be our graduation speaker at Southern Adventist University. And she arrived there on campus, and I still remember at that time, she wasn't working for Goldman Sachs, she was working for the government, and she was in charge of all of the Southern Hemisphere in this part of the world, and in charge of working with the White House in that particular arena. And I remember asking her, it was shortly after we had invaded, and my colleague, Philip Simon, who's originally from Syria, teaches in the School of Religion at Southern, we asked her, is there an exit strategy? Do we know what we're doing over there, and do we really understand what the mindset of people in the Middle East is all about? And she assured us that, yes, of course, there is an exit strategy. All this has been thought through and everything. But as we can see here, part of that exit strategy left a vacuum that really has been taken advantage of in a major, major way. And I think part of this is simply a lack of understanding many times of some of the issues that we face. The longer I have spent time in the Middle East, I can tell you this, it's one of the most complex places politically that I know in the world. And it is, the longer I spend time there, the less of an expert I am, to be quite honest with you. Not that I'm a diplomat, I'm an archaeologist, but anyway, you see all kinds of things there. This is the Baghdad Mosque. You have to understand that Baghdad, the capital of Iraq, was one of the key centers for Islamic civilization. Cairo and Baghdad were the two major centers. And so this was a devastating thing for many people. This is the great ziggurat of Ur. This is from the city that Abraham came from as he left Ur and went into the land of Canaan, the land that God would show him. Here are some of our military vehicles in front of the what's left of that great ziggurat at Ur. Babylon is about 52 miles south of Baghdad. We're going to talk about Babylon extensively today. And Saddam Hussein's ambition was to make Iraq the dominant power in the region. That was his goal. He was going to be the leader that would unite the Arab world and make that kind of the dominant power. That was part of his ambition to take over Kuwait. And that was when I was in college in the early 1990s, the first Iraq war. We find this in a number of different places. This is my colleague and friend, Dr. Eric Klein from George Washington University in Washington, D.C. He says this in his book, "The picture could not be more startlingly clear. Saddam has used as a blueprint for his life the exploits of Nebuchadnezzar. The evidence is clear. He will sacrifice everything for his ambition to destroy Israel, to become the leader of the Middle East, and to leave a legacy of greatness in his building. Saddam also portrays himself as the successor to Nebuchadnezzar. In 1979, he was quoted by his semi-official biographer as saying, 'Nebuchadnezzar stirs in me everything related to pre-Islamic ancient history.'" How can we see this in the works in Iraq itself? Well, here we see the famous statue of Saddam Hussein being toppled in Baghdad. Did he really seek to become the new Nebuchadnezzar? Let's look at the evidence. Here's a minted medal that was minted for the first Babylon International Festival in 1987. This is the year I graduated from high school, so now you can kind of do some figuring in your mind and figure out how old I am. But this is what was minted. Now notice this coin or this medal. It's very interesting. Who is this in the foreground? That's Saddam Hussein. Who is this in the background? Nebuchadnezzar. And how do we know that? Because here on the side in Arabic we have the name of the first Babylonian International Film Festival, or not film, but International Festival. But on this side, we have it written in cuneiform, the ancient form of writing of the Babylonian Empire. Very interesting. Here's another billboard from the side of the road. This was taken by a friend of mine, a captain in the U.S. Navy also a major in the Marines. He had two ranks and worked in two different agencies or branches of the military. And I'll tell you a little bit more about him later. But he took this picture in 2003 in the initial incursion into Iraq. And this was on the side of the road. I want to just analyze this a little bit. My wife is the art historian. She would go to town with this. But I can tell you a little bit here what we can see. Here is another one of these coins. And here we have an ancient face, right? That's Nebuchadnezzar. Here we have, again, Saddam Hussein in the foreground, a young Saddam. What do we have in the background? Nebuchadnezzar. That's an ancient king. His helmet, his beard, everything denotes that. Here we have ancient vehicles of warfare, a chariot, horses. Here we have Saddam in uniform looking straight out at you, okay, with an eagle on above his head. And here we have a woman looking forward. This is an AK-47, which is a modern weapon of warfare, a very popular weapon of warfare. Behind him is the land and a tree, which represents fertility and is a very important symbol in the Middle East. The greenness of the land indicates prosperity. This communicates volumes to a Middle Easterner who's looking at this. Okay, that was on the side of the road as we went into Baghdad in 2003. Let's go back, because why did Saddam Hussein look at Nebuchadnezzar for his inspiration? What makes this country, Iraq, so important? We talk about the cradle of civilization. The cradle of civilization goes from the Tigris and Euphrates rivers north of the Persian Gulf. It goes, of course, they run downhill from the mountains in the northern part of the country and in the areas of the Indo-European areas up above. But we come around there, we go into Turkey, and then we come down through Syria and Lebanon, and we come into Israel, where we have the Sea of Galilee and the Jordan River providing water there. We have a bit of a gap all of a sudden with the Sinai Peninsula, and then we come to the fertile Nile Valley of Egypt. This is known as the Fertile Crescent. It's kind of shaped like a crescent, because down here in this area, what do you have? You have the Arabian Peninsula, which is desert, and not many people can live there. Certainly ancient civilizations couldn't experience much there. And so this was extremely, extremely important for them. This is also where the firsts in civilization took place. This territory. Iraq really is one of the richest places for civilization. Incredible. And when I think about the horrible things that are happening today to the monuments in Syria and in northern Iraq, it makes me cringe. Of course, that pales in comparison to what's happening to the people there, who are being also persecuted and having a difficult time. These are some of the earliest figures that we have from ancient Sumer, the first kingdom mentioned. The first written language was ancient Sumerian. And these are individuals with their hands folded, their eyes wide open, gazing out. Some people think maybe even gazing upward. Very interesting stance, but these are some of the earliest figures that we have. The Tigris and the Euphrates rivers providing an alluvial plain for agriculture. This was where first the agricultural revolution took place, and where agriculture was practiced, where the first city-states were built along the Tigris and the Euphrates. Here we have a map, and here you see Sumer down here, Babylon, Assyria. We talked about Assyria in the last presentation. Now we're going to be talking about this southern area over here. Here you had the first major cities ever built. Now in the Bible, cities are not good things, they're bad things. You ever read the Bible and see that? God didn't intend for us necessarily to live in cities. He wanted people to live on the land. Have you wondered why Babylon has become kind of, well, it wasn't just because of that, but cities were not deemed as something good. But in Mesopotamian culture and Sumerian culture, the cities represented civilization. And these two of these cities here are mentioned already in the book of Genesis. Uruk is Erech, E-R-E-C-H, usually in the book of Genesis. And Ur, of course, we've already mentioned, is the city in southern Iraq today where Abraham came from. So they had the first major city or city-states at that time. The first kings, the first king lists that we have, the Sumerian king lists and others, the first kings. This may be Sargon. We're not sure. There's no inscription telling us who this is, but a beautiful artifact, beautifully executed The first written language the Sumerians had. We don't know what the Sumerians called themselves. We call them Sumerians because the tablets that the language was written on was discovered at Sumer, so they're the Sumerians. It was wedge-shaped writing or cuneiform writing that began with a kind of picture. They're pictographic writings, kind of like Chinese. Then that was done with a reed stylus impressed in clay. I have a cuneiform object I'm going to be passing around later. You see it here. This is the Cyrus cylinder. No, it's not the Cyrus cylinder. It's a replica. The original is in the British Museum. But I'm going to pass that around. You can look at what cuneiform looks. So they had the first writing. And they had the first schools. Scribes that were teaching other scribes and children how to read and how to write. Now, this is the front and the back of a single tablet. The original is in the Yale Babylonian collection. I want you to look at this, and I want you to guess which one is the scribe or professor's side, and which one is the student's side. How many of you think this is the professor's side? Okay, you think this one's the professor's side. How many of you think this is the professor's side? Do we have any doctors here? You guys ever seen a professor's handwriting? Do you know anything about how we write? Why we type everything now? Because nobody can read our handwriting? I'm kidding. My handwriting's terrible, but I'm guessing you're right. I think probably this is the scribe side. I'm hoping that he was a good scribe, and this is maybe the student side. But you can see they would flip these tablets over. One would write on one side. These were wet, of course. I tell the students when I show them the cuneiform tablets in our collection, we have several from the city of Ur from the time of Abraham, and I show them some of the tablets are this small, some of them are this large. I used to bring them with me as well, and they won't do that anymore. But anyway, I asked them, I said, wouldn't it be fun, you know, when your teacher has a writing assignment to go out in the playground and get into a pile of mud someplace and make some nice clay tablets like that and then start writing on them? And they're like, oh, yeah, yeah. And their teachers are all like, no. That wouldn't be fun at all. It would be dirty and terrible, and the parents would hate us for it. But that's what they used to have to do back then. The first mathematics, actually, we still use the Babylonian system, the sexagesimal system, in several of our mathematical computations. Do you know multiplication? This is an exam, by the way. This is an exam that is given to somebody who is learning math back then, and let me see how you would do. I'll read you the question or the series of questions and see whether you would pass the exam. Do you know multiplication, reciprocals, coefficients, balancing of accounts, administrative accounting, and how to make all kinds of pay allotments? Divide property and delimit shares of fields. So this was something that a person who was an exam had to know. I know I would not pass at this point in time. The famous British Museum in 1872, George Smith is going through a series of tablets in the basement of the British Museum, and he's carefully looking through those tablets and is reading them. He's one of the few individuals at that time in history that read the language, and he's reading through this, and all of a sudden he recognizes a story about a flood and an Utnapishtim and a Gilgamesh who goes out seeking for the secret of eternal life. And he gets excited because this is a story of a flood. And Utnapishtim reminds him of Noah, the survivor of the flood. And so he quickly writes up his ideas, and it gets published in the Times, and it becomes a sensation in Europe. The famous Gilgamesh epic is found, and many of you read about it in your textbooks today. It's not really a story of a flood. It's a story within a story, but it was found in 1872. Do you know that these museums around the world... Oh, thank you. That's so nice of you to return this artifact. Are there others floating around there? No. Keep passing it around. It's all right. Yeah, I would like to take them home with me, if that's okay. That's great. Anyway, did you know that there are thousands, even tens of thousands of cuneiform tablets? Yes, Pastor. Oh, you didn't see the Philistine one. All right, thank you. We'll pass that around here too. That's the Philistine one. And make sure the ballista doesn't get thrown across, but gets over on the other side too, okay? All right, so George Smith, did you know that there are tens of thousands of cuneiform tablets in the basements of these museums that have not even been read, let alone published? I asked the Yale University curator when we were there this past year, I asked her, I said, how many of your cuneiform tablets, they have a collection of 40,000 cuneiform tablets. You've heard of J.P. Morgan? J.P. Morgan Chase. I have a credit card in my pocket from that bank. J.P. Morgan Chase. J.P. Morgan was one of the first donors to the Yale University collection. He was a collector, and he gave a collection of cuneiform tablets that he had purchased as part of his collection as a multimillionaire back in the day. And, of course, others gave as well. Why did they give to Yale University these collections? Because Yale University, in the early days, in the 1800s, was a religious institution. You know, Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, and all these schools began as religious institutions, primarily to train ministers and primarily to train individuals. And it's only been in recent years that they have been more, obviously Harvard goes way back. But when Harvard became too liberal, Yale was established. And when Yale became too liberal, Princeton was. And so on down the line. And so all of our Ivy League schools, many of them have that background. And you still can see when you go on campus, you can still see the inscriptions on the walls. There are biblical verses written and etched in the stone of these buildings on these campuses. So I asked them, I said, how many of your tablets, 40,000 tablets that you have, how many are published? They said, only 20,000 of them. Half. So I said, what about the other 20,000? Well, we don't have enough people to really go through. It's very difficult. There's a digitizing process now for all of these tablets in these various museums so that more scholars can have access. Let me just tell you a story here. In 2007, that's fairly recent, man, it's already 17, so that's 10 years ago now. There's kids here that are younger than when this was happening, and I remember when it first happened, and it was really exciting. Now it's old news almost. Well, it's newer than 1872 at least, so I'll share it with you. In 2007, a Viennese scholar from Vienna, Austria, was working in the basement of the British Museum trying to find the names on various Babylonian tablets, because there are thousands of them in the basement of the British Museum, again, that haven't been read, let alone published. And as he was looking, he found a small tablet that had a name on it, Nebusarsakim. Not Nebuchadnezzar, Nebusarsakim. Well, actually, Nebuchadnezzar was on this tablet as well. The tablet was dated to the 10th year of Nebuchadnezzar. And he became very excited because, you see, this scholar, Professor Yursu, also knew his Bible. And he remembered that in Jeremiah, in a passage that most people just read past because it just lists a bunch of officials, there's a certain Nebusarsakim, the Rabsaris, who is mentioned there. Or the Rapmag, I'm sorry, the Rapmag. And he said, wow, it dates to the right time period. It comes from Babylon. This person was, but he was one of the officials that Nebuchadnezzar told the situation. And we now have a tablet for the first time mentioning that person's name. So who knows how many of these tens of thousands of tablets that are in the basements of the museums in Istanbul, in Berlin, in here, in various places, at Yale, at Chicago, at Harvard, even at Andrews. Well, no, Andrews has published its 3,000 tablets. Yes. Okay. How many of them have names or have details, or where is another Gilgamesh epic that will be uncovered? We don't have enough people to read these languages, let alone publish them. It's very exciting. So this was the first flood story. Here it is. We also have the first creation story, the Eridu Genesis, written in 1600 BC. That is 150 years before the earliest date given to Moses. The Exodus happened around 1447, 1450 or so. This is 150 years older than when the book of Genesis was written. And we have a story of the first creation. This caused a sensation in Europe when it was first discovered. And it started the famous Babel versus Bible debate. Was the Bible original? Or were these Babylonian stories original, and that the Bible writers just borrow it from the Babylon? There was a famous lectureship that took place before Kaiser Wilhelm II, the emperor of the German Empire at that time, in 1906, and Friedrich Dillich posed that question and took the position that the Bible borrowed everything from Mesopotamia. So you know what I do in my class? I have my students read through these. No, not in the original, in translation. I don't read this. I don't read Sumerian. I have them read through these, and I have them compare these ancient mythologies about creation and the flood with the Bible. We look for similarities, and there are some similarities. There are boats involved, and there's people involved, and there is a flood involved, and there are some similarities. And then we look for differences. And wow, are there major differences. Pantheon of gods. You know how creation took place? You know the reason for creation in these epics? The reason for creation in the Atrahasis epic, the reason for creation is this. The gods needed workers to dig the canals and build the cities to create us to do that for them. So they didn't have to work. Do you know what the reason for the flood was? We made too much noise. They couldn't sleep at night. They got so angry because we were so noisy and they couldn't sleep. So what did they do? They planned a whole series of ways to exterminate us. And first they tried disease, and then they tried a famine. And then when that didn't work, finally Enlil goes to the pantheon and says, we need to send a flood to wipe them out once and for all. Anyway, it's interesting. You get a whole different picture of God, or I should say the gods of Mesopotamia. They are very capricious. They're very human-like. And it's interesting, in fact. Ur is the home of Abraham. And I have to tell you a story here about this. My friend, Dr. Tom Mary, who I mentioned a moment ago, was a captain in the U.S. Navy and a major in the Marines. He was flying in a helicopter with the two top generals over the landscape of southern Iraq. He was part of the original expeditionary force into Iraq in 2003, the first 6 months. Dr. Tom Mary is a physician. He's a flight surgeon. And he was placed in charge of all of the medical operations, Baghdad and south, during that invasion. He's also a graduate of Loma Linda Medical School. And as he was flying over, and he doesn't live far from here, I think he lives right over here in Reno, Nevada. As he was flying over the landscape, suddenly he recognized the ziggurat of Ur down below. He had taken some kind of a Bible class when he was at Loma Linda, and he remembered that. And he looked down, he says, over the din of the helicopter, he says, that's Ur down there. What did you say, soldier? It's Ur down there. They had their headphones on and everything, but it still didn't make any sense. What's Ur? Ur, where Abraham came from. Abraham who? Well, the Abraham of the Bible, the Abraham that came from this place and went to Canaan, the Abraham that, you know, that Abraham. That's the city down there. That's Ur. Yes, well, what about it? It's an important city. Son, we have a war to run. We don't have time to talk about archaeology and cities down there. He said, I know that, sir, but that would be an important one to protect. Yep, that could be. What other cities should we protect? Tom Mary didn't have to think but for a second. He says, well, Babylon. All right, we don't have time for this conversation. We've got other things to focus on, but we're placing you in charge of Babylon and Ur in addition to your other responsibilities. Now, by the way, as in charge of the, we're having this conversation, Dr. Mary and I, at Olive Garden back in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where he came to lecture at Southern, and he's telling me this story, and he said, oh my goodness, he says, I didn't know what to do with myself. I says, well, what did you do? He says, well, I set up my medical headquarters at Babylon, outside the city of Babylon. I said, really? He says, yep. I said, in fact, the first nights I was there, he said, I slept in Saddam Hussein's palace that he had built right outside of Babylon. We'll talk about that in a moment. I'll show you a picture of that. This is the ziggurat at Ur, that big black blob right there. This is the whole precinct that was dug by the British and by the University of Pennsylvania in the early 1900s and the 1930s. They uncovered several palaces, Shulgi's Palace and Ornamu's Palace over here. The ziggurat was built during that time. This was a temple tower dedicated to the moon god and her consort, or his consort. And there were a lot of different things. There were treasures. There was a huge, huge cemetery of the kings. This is about 300 years before the time of Abraham. Here you can see some pictures of the early excavations where they would hire 200 or 300 workers and they would be working in the field. And if we did something like this and had a wall of remaining material like this, I mean, this is the surface of the site up here and this is the trench down here. If we had something like that, we would be shut down by the government in Israel because that can cave in and cause all kinds of problems. We had a young man in Ashkelon, not while I was there, but a year later, that they had a cave in and he was not. So here we have the famous ziggurat to the moon god Sin. By the way, there's no connection to the English word Sin. That's just his native language. And we can imagine this temple tower. Some people think that this is maybe what the Tower of Babel might have looked like. But we have these ziggurats, including one in Babylon as well. Ur at that time, during the Ur III period, was the most advanced city in the world. It was the capital, really, of Mesopotamia at that time. It was the first city-state that began to conquer other areas. And it was a very, very important center. And it was during this time, if we get our biblical chronology right, and there's always a question about that, but if we get our biblical chronology right, it was during this time when Ur was at its apex that Abraham would have been living there. So I want you to imagine that you're Abraham and that you're called out of Ur. What would be the most sophisticated apex city of our world today? I don't know. I go to New York every year with my wife. We lead an art appreciation tour and visit all the museums. Is it New York? Is it Los Angeles? Is it London? Is it Berlin? Is it Singapore? Is it Tokyo? But imagine you would be called out to go to the land that God would show you, and you have no idea where you're going. The amazing thing with Abraham is he not only believed, but he acted. And it's the action that was counted to him as righteousness. It's not enough simply to believe something. Faith is an action word, and it requires action. It's not enough to simply have an intellectual belief. It's what we do with that belief that is counted as righteousness, and according to what we read later in Hebrews chapter 11. So Abraham goes out. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go, and he went out not knowing where he was going. I have a colleague at Southern Adventist University, teaches in the business department. He actually used to teach here at Weimar some years ago, now taught at the business department for many years, and he has just decided to take an early retirement. He's not really, he's young still, he doesn't need to retire now. I said, what are you going to be doing, Bob? Rob. I always guess it's Robert. Is it Bob or Rob? I think he goes by Rob. So what are you doing, Rob? He says, my wife and I are going to Bolivia. Oh, well, you got set up there. He says, nothing. When we arrive, the Lord will tell us what to do. He did the same thing in India. Yeah. The Lord will tell us when we get there. Here are some of the treasures found at Ur. Queen Puabi's headdress. Ladies, what do you think? Was this what Paul was talking about with embroidering hair? This is about 2,400 years before the time of Paul. So look at that thing that comes up over the back. It's quite amazing, huh? This is in the British Museum now. This is a golden goblet. It didn't quite compare to the plastic stuff that we had. Imagine drinking out of that. It's about this tall. It's pure gold, solid gold. Look at the artwork. Look at how it's fluted. Look at the etching around the top. Beautiful. This was the one that was really exciting to Leonard Woolley when he found it, the British archaeologist. He found two of them like this. One is in the British Museum. One is at the University Museum at the University of Pennsylvania. And when he saw it, he immediately thought of Abraham and the story of Abraham taking Isaac up to Mount Moriah and Abraham almost sacrificing his son there, also a tremendous act of faith. And he thought about that when he saw this ram. He called it the ram caught in the thicket. It's beautiful. It has ivory as its coat, lapis, and covered in gold, sheet gold. So Abraham left Ur to travel a huge distance. We think this is maybe the route that he would have taken, the migration he would have taken. This is an alternate route. He stopped at Haran for a while. That's where his father died. And then he continued here and eventually went also to Egypt, as you know. It is from this ancient civilization that we have the first map of the world on this cuneiform tablet. I want to draw your attention to something. Notice that the world is round. Do not presume that the ancients were stupid or uncivilized or that we have things together today because, you know, Columbus, when he sailed, thought maybe he would, or some people thought he might go over the edge, right? Because the earth was flat or square or whatever. He may have thought that. That's why we call those the Dark Ages. But the ancients didn't. The world was round. And Babylon, by the way, is right in the center. Marked right in the center. By the way, that's not by accident as well. When you look at a map and you buy it here in the United States, what is at the center? If you're in China, it might be a little different. The world, right? So the Bible, by the way, depicts the world as round as well and not as flat. Hammurabi in 1792 BC, the famous Hammurabi Code. This is the top of it. Hammurabi was the first king of Babylon way, way back when. This is 1,100 years, almost 1,200 years before the time of Nebuchadnezzar. Hammurabi uses Babylon as his capital, and he establishes the first Babylonian kingdom. And he erects this famous stela, or this famous code, that is now at the Louvre in Paris. And he is depicted standing in front of the sun god Shamash. You see the rays emanating from his shoulders. And some people date him to 1792. Here's the whole legal code that you see here, over 300 laws. 1,200 years before Nebuchadnezzar existed. So this is the ancient Babylonian Empire. When we think about Nebuchadnezzar, it's the Neo or New Babylonian Empire that we're dealing with. And it started in 605 BC with Nabopolassar, the defeat of the Assyrians prior to that time. Nabopolassar establishing the Neo-Babylonian Empire, and then Nebuchadnezzar following along. In his first campaign in 605 BC, Nebuchadnezzar goes to Jerusalem. And there, while he's in Jerusalem, he gathers the best of the nobles to take them back with him to be trained in the Babylonian court. And among them are Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. Why do we always call them by their Babylonian names? And Daniel. Why do we always call him by his Hebrew name? Is that just an Adventist thing? I don't know. What were they all had Hebrew names, right? What was Daniel's Babylonian name? Belteshazzar, okay. What were the other three's biblical Hebrew names? Yeah, Mishael, Azariah, and Hananiah, okay. So thank you. What are the ayahs at the end? Yahweh. In Hebrew, it's Yahu, which has nothing to do with a website or a chocolate drink, okay. Yahu, Yahweh, it's a shortened form of Yahweh. What does Daniel have at the end? Daniel. Okay? God is my judge. The my is the E, the L is God, Dan. God is my judge. Okay? That's what Daniel means. Okay? So they had good Hebrew names with good, God was in there. My name is Michael. That L at the end, my name means who is like God. So, they had good Hebrew names, but when they arrived at Babylon, what happened? They wanted to be made into good Babylonian citizens, and part of that was to change their names and give them names that reflected the Babylonian gods. So Bel, one of the leading Babylonian gods, Bel is the same as Baal in the Bible, the derivative. Anyway, that's just an aside. We need to keep moving. Some scholars believe this was the ancient site of the Tower of Babel. The word Babylon, Babel, it actually comes from the word Babel, and this is where, by the way, it probably wasn't like that. Okay, we saw a ziggurat a moment ago, probably was a little bit different. Robert Koldewey, a German scholar, began working in Babylon in 1899 through 1917. Up to this point in time, scholars didn't know a whole lot about Babylon. There had been some earlier short expeditions there, a few tablets were gathered, things, but the first real full-scale excavation that took place was by Robert Koldewey. One of the key questions that people were asking at the time was, how do we know that the story recorded in Daniel is true? I mean, there's some claims that are made there that are quite incredible. Now, let's look at the size of Babylon compared to other ancient cities of the world. Nineveh was the capital of the preceding empire, the Assyrian Empire. We talked about Nineveh today at 11 o'clock. So it was 2.9 square miles in size. Right? That's one capital. Ancient Rome, the Roman Empire, moving way ahead, was about 1 square mile in size. Ancient Athens, the philosophical capital of Greece. Of course, Greece was never really united until Alexander the Great, or until his father Philip of Macedon united these. And by that time, Athens had lost its prominence. But in its heyday, Athens was less than a square mile. And then we have ancient Babylon, 4 square miles in size, almost twice as large as the largest capital of its time. I got these images by permission from a gentleman in Turkey who has done amazing reconstructions, digital reconstructions of Babylon and what it would have looked like in ancient times based on the excavations and what we know from satellite imagery. Look at that. That's the ziggurat. The Euphrates River was made to flow right through the city. That's impressive. I want you to think that you're Daniel and you're a young teenager with your three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and you're arriving at the gates of Babylon. Babylon, by the way, may not have been finished at this point in time, at the beginning, but during the years, during the 60 or 70 years that Daniel served, he would have seen this city be built. It had been part, a very important part, of the government as this city built up by Nebuchadnezzar, who was the longest reigning king of that dynasty. Babylon had an estimated food supply of 20 years packed inside those city walls and those gates. It was punctuated on all sides by 8 different gates. Each of them were named according to a different Egyptian god. I'm sorry, Egyptian. Babylonian god. That's another lecture on Egypt. You can see the walls. There was a triple wall around the city. Very, very impressive. How high were the walls? Well, the further along you get, we really don't know, because when we excavate these walls and when we excavate these ancient sites, we only find the foundations of these walls. In the case of Babylon, a lot of it was preserved and many of the walls could be reconstructed, and we will talk about that in a moment. If you read the ancient sources, the Greek sources, and of course Herodotus was almost a contemporary of this time. He was living in the 6th, 5th century B.C. And if you look later on, by 64 to 24 B.C., Strabo says that they were 200 feet high. Now, we think that's probably an exaggeration. It goes from 50 feet high, depending on who you read, all the way to 200 feet. It keeps escalating as time goes on. 200 feet, how high would that be? 20 stories. I think in Grass Valley there's a. I don't even know in Chattanooga if there's a 20-story building. They have a population of 350,000. Maybe in Sacramento? I don't think it was that high. Somewhere maybe between 50, even 50 feet. Think about 50 feet. 5 stories. How high is this ceiling? Maybe 3? Add another 20 feet on top of that. That's the height of the walls. There were no F-18 fighter jets, no smart bombs, no drones back then. You try to get through a triple wall that's that high. What Herodotus does write is that the walls, by the way, the inner wall, city wall, was surrounded by double walls, 12 and 22 feet wide. Herodotus writes that the wall, the wide wall, was wide enough for 2 charioteers to run alongside each other on top of the wall. Impressive. The walls around the city, as I said, had 8 gates. This is the famous, of course, most famous gate that's been reconstructed in Berlin. Some of you have probably been to the museum in Berlin and seen this gate. The Germans took it apart piece by piece and reassembled it in Berlin at the Pergamon Museum. And it's a fantastic sight to see the Ishtar Gate, named after one of the female fertility goddesses. Later, she's known as Aphrodite to the ancient Greeks. And prior to this time, she's known as Asherah in the Bible, or Astarte by the Canaanites. And prior to that time, she was known as Hathor in the Egyptians. There's nothing new under the sun, folks. I think Solomon wrote that, right? There's nothing new under the sun. These deities were worshipped from generation and from civilization to civilization for thousands of years. They just changed names and some aspects changed, but that was the reality. Here are the German scientists putting these millions of pieces of brick back together. They were all numbered. Makes Humpty Dumpty look like a joke. This is the procession way at the Pergamon Museum. On either side of the procession way, as you approached the gate in ancient Babylon, there were lions. 120 lions lining the procession way. Here you see the lion. The lion was the symbol of Babylon. And that should not surprise us, because in Daniel chapter 7, how is Babylon depicted? As a lion with wings. By the way, there's a little bit of a discussion. Is this a wing? I have my doubts. I do evangelistic meetings on this as well. And I've worked with Mark Finley, and I've worked with Ron Clouzet, and I've worked more recently with John Bradshaw. And I'm always very, very careful with this, because I've been to Africa and I've seen lions out in the wild in Tanzania, and some of their manes extend all the way down underneath their bodies to about that point. Not on me. I don't have a mane. Here's a conquering lion right outside the city of Babylon. This is actually an ancient artifact that is from Babylon, and it shows a lion pouncing on top of a human being, on top of a man. And here you can see this. You can see a soldier standing to the side. This is the conquering lion. Again, the lion is the symbol for ancient Babylon. So here in Daniel 7, we read, "The first was like a lion, and it had eagle's wings." Of course, lions don't have eagle's wings, and these creatures were composite creatures, symbolic creatures that symbolize the swiftness of the Babylonian Empire and its conquering the then known world. But at any rate, it's interesting that you have that connection. Here's another one of these. Isn't this incredible? Look at this city. It's another image from this friend of mine in Turkey. And this one. So when Daniel writes in Daniel chapter 4, verse 30, is not this, and Nebuchadnezzar here is speaking. You remember, he's walking along the walls of the city, and he's looking down upon the great city that he had built. And this is what he says: "Is not this great Babylon I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor?" Scholars for decades, particularly after the French Revolution, as we entered actually in the 1600s already, as we entered in the Age of Enlightenment into this critical mode of thinking towards the Bible, scholars for decades had questioned, how could Nebuchadnezzar make the claim to be the builder of Babylon? Babylon had existed for hundreds, even over 1,000 years prior to his time. How could he claim to build the city? It's like the mayor of New York today saying, "Is this not great New York that I've built power and for the honor of my majesty?" Well, maybe he could take credit for part of the reconstruction of Freedom Tower there in New York after the Twin Towers went down in 9/11. But he can't take credit for the Empire State Building and the other buildings that have been there long before he was in power. So again, scholars were asking, how is this possible? Well, it wasn't until excavations began and we began to find thousands and thousands of the clay bricks that were used to build Babylon. And I'm sorry, sometimes on these trips I actually bring my own clay brick with me. I have a brick. I have two pieces. You see the whole inscription here. I only have fragments of the inscription. But what does the inscription say? "Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, builder of the temple of Esagila and Azita, eldest son of Nabopolassar, king of Babylon." Thousands of bricks stamped over and over, and that stamp. There's no question in anybody's mind since Koldevay excavated there in 1899 to 1917 that, in fact, his father started the process, but Nebuchadnezzar spent the rest of his career finishing the process. And we know that he rebuilt Babylon to an opulence and splendor that it had never experienced. The city had been destroyed by the Assyrians, and he rebuilt it. So yes, he could claim. He could make this claim. Here's another one. They weren't all square like that. This is a longer one. It says the same thing. This is the one, I think, in the university collection. What's interesting is, and here we have a reconstruction. Here we have some of the remnants of the walls. What's interesting is below the water table, very down deep, you have bricks that are stamped with Hammurabi's name. And then you have bricks that are stamped by Nebuchadnezzar's name. And then today, in the 20th century, in the 21st century, guess what? the rebuilding that you see in the background, we have thousands of bricks stamped with Saddam Hussein's name. I kid you not. There it is. It's in Arabic. And if I had my computer in front of me, I could read you in the inscription. Did Saddam Hussein see himself as a successor to Nebuchadnezzar? Saddam Hussein decided to rebuild ancient Babylon. In fact, he ordered a cable car, the kind of cable car that we have maybe at Heavenly Valley over here, the ski resort overlooking Lake Tahoe, you know, to take skiers up to the top of a mountain. He ordered a Swiss cable car so that he could run it across the entire breadth of Babylon. And when dignitaries and ambassadors and other heads of state arrived to see this great city that he was rebuilding, he could across the city. He built a palace outside the city. That's his palace. This is what Tom Mary tells me. He says, I slept for the first couple of nights before we set up our camp. He said, I slept for the first couple of nights. In fact, I set up my pup tent inside Uday's bedroom. Uday was one of the sons, Saddam Hussein, who was known for his tyranny. All the floors were hard marble. He says, it just felt strange. It felt like there was evil all around me. Jeremiah 51, verse 46 says, a rumor will come one year, and after that in another year a rumor will come, and violence in the land, ruler against ruler. Thus Babylon shall sink and not rise from the catastrophe that I will bring upon her. Prophecy. Jeremiah and Daniel are contemporaries, but in Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. You remember that dream in Daniel chapter 2, right? Nebuchadnezzar has a dream, and Daniel's called to interpret that dream eventually when he asks for a time frame where he can pray and receive an interpretation. And here I'll tell another story from my grandfather's experience in the Second World War. As I mentioned last night, and I probably didn't mention the children's story today, but my grandfather was a German pastor, literature evangelist, and Adventist servant who were drafted into the German army at the Second World War. And at one particular occasion, as he was serving in Unit 699, and one of the church members today shared with me, because I didn't know last night what his rank was, I told them it was an Offizier. That's the German officer. He told me that would be the equivalent to a sergeant. I looked that up. So as my grandfather was called in, he was the company clerk, as he was called into his commanding officer's makeshift office one day, he was asked a very pointed question. Do you believe that Germany is going to win this war? Because as a soldier serving in the army, your expected answer would obviously be, of course we're going to win the war, and we'll do everything in our power to win the war. But my grandfather had studied his Bible and was a careful student of the Bible, and he had studied his Bible to the extent that he understood the prophecies, and he knew in his heart that according to biblical prophecy, and particularly according to the book of Daniel, there was no way, if the Bible was correct, that Hitler could ever win the war. In fact, he knew that it would be impossible. And he had already been giving Bible studies to some of the other men in his unit and sharing this with them. And so word had gotten to his commanding officer, and now he was asked the question. And my grandfather knew it was a very delicate situation. If he would answer yes, it would be what was expected. But if he would be true to his conscience, he could face court-martial and even death. Because to be unloyal to the army at this time in Earth's history was not a very pleasant thing to have happen. And so he said a silent prayer, and then he asked, suddenly he got an idea. And he said, I'm gonna ask. You see, they had an unwritten code among the officers that if they weren't wearing their caps, they could talk about things off the record. These guys were with each other 24/7. There were times when they just needed to talk about things, you know. And his commanding officer thought for a moment, and he says, okay, I'll let you in. He took off his hat. My grandfather did this to give a Bible study to his commanding. He had a small piece of paper folded in that spot. He took out that piece of paper. He unfolded it in four parts. And as he unfolded it, there was the image of a head of gold and arms and chest. I'm sorry, and thighs of brass and legs of iron and feet of iron mixed with clay. And as he went through the empires of Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, finally got down to the feet of iron mixed. This is the breakup of the Roman Empire. And while Rome continues in the iron into the toes, clay does not cleave with iron. And just as clay does not cleave with iron, Hitler will not be successful in the Third Reich a Reich that would last 1,000 years. As he delivered that punchline, the commanding officer was very thoughtful, and he says, "Okay, can I have that book?" My grandfather left his office, and that evening as he went to bed, his prayer went something like this. He says, "Lord, may the testimony that I share today not return void, but I ask you this more than any." It was the first time in the war that my grandfather, and he couldn't think about going through the rest of the war with him. The next morning, as he woke up, he reported for duty. And as he walked into the makeshift office of his commanding officer, he didn't recognize, two high-ranking officers. And immediately his heart sank. He thought he had been betrayed. But just as he had that thought, his commanding officer removed his hat and told everybody else in the room to do the same thing, and then instructed everyone that the conversation that was going to be taking place was off the record. In fact, the conversation never took place. And he handed my grandfather back his Bible, and he says, "I want you to tell us everything that you told me yesterday. Do not leave out one on Daniel chapter 2. And he went through the head of gold, Babylon, 605 to 539, the arms and chest of silver, Medo-Persia, 639. And he kept going down. And he noticed every time he mentioned dates, there was a look that passed between the three men that he was telling this Bible study to. He couldn't quite make it out, but kind of a look of recognition, kind of an unspoken kind of look that had gone. And he continued with his Bible study, and finally he came down to the feet of iron mixed with clay, and he said, "Just as iron does not cleave with clay," he says, "there can be no Third Reich that lasts 1,000 years. Hitler cannot win this war. Just as these prophecies have been fulfilled in the past, and these kingdoms have existed in the past and have fallen in the past, so the prophecy will be sure even today in our time." Do you believe that today? You know, that was just what? That was our time, as far as I'm concerned. The commanding officer thanked him. He repeated his instructions to the other two men, and he dismissed my grandfather. As my grandfather headed towards the door, he said, "Oh, by the way," he said, "let me introduce you to the two men. And by the way, somebody here has the book, 1,000 Shall Fall. And I need to read the book again because I haven't for a while. And I don't remember the names of the two officers, so I'm going to make them up. Is that okay?" They're in the book. You can look what they actually were. This is Herr Schmidt. I'm going to use very common names. Smith in German. This is Herr Schmidt. Prior to being drafted into the German army, Professor Schmidt was a professor of history, and he named a very prestigious. And Professor Schmidt has confirmed of events and dates that you have provided. Oh, and this is Captain Müller. And Captain Müller, before joining the army and before being drafted, was a gymnasium teacher of history, and he has also confirmed the dates. Evidently, there had been reinforcements that had come in, and these men officer found them. And he thanked my grandfather. My grandfather left the room rejoicing because the Word of God was restored in his breast pocket, because God's Word had been fulfilled. 6 months later, the war ended. And now they were faced with the Herculean task of making their way from 2,000 miles into the southern heart of Russia. They had almost reached the city of Baku. How the war would have turned, I don't know if the Russians were, and that was what Hitler was hoping to gain. But now they were tasked with going back all the way to Germany. My grandfather didn't know this, but those months earlier, a Bible study had convinced to conserve every ounce of gas, to preserve as much food as possible. My grandfather made it back to Germany. He was the first Seventh-day Adventist minister intact. Of the original 1,200 men, and this is the middle of the book that comes from Psalm 9, of the original 1,200 men, that unit had been replaced four times in the course of, there were at least 4,000 men that cycled through that unit. The attrition rate at the front lines, of the original 1,200, only seven survived. My grandfather was one of those seven. Only three of those seven were never wounded. God is faithful, and God is sovereign as he reigns in his throne above the earth. I shared some of these pictures yesterday. That's my grandfather on the right, bridge building unit. Unit 699, you can see the heavy vehicles going across the pontoon bridge that they had just built across the Dnieper River in the heart of the Ukraine. The bridge behind it was the bridge that was bombed out by the Russians, so the Germans could not advance. They were in charge of building bridges so that they could advance. So going back to Babylon, how did such a mighty city fall? What took place? Herodotus, the historian, tells us the fascinating story. Cyrus had planned to attack in the spring, but one of his royal horses, one of his sacred horses, drowned in the Euphrates River. It made Cyrus so furious that the river destroyed his horse that he decided to destroy the river. So he ordered his troops to dig canals and spread out the river over the plain. He didn't want the river to be there at all anymore. And once he had done that, he was able, with his troops, on the night of October 12, 539, the night, by the way, that we read about in Daniel chapter 5, when there's a great and ruckus party taking place, and Belshazzar is throwing a feast and suddenly sees a hand without attachment to any body writing something on a wall. When he sees the handwriting on the wall that very night, the armies of Cyrus march in to Babylon. There is not an arrow that is shot. There is no fight that takes place. There has been a party going on for weeks, and now they come in on pretty much dry ground. We are told the story in the famous Cyrus cylinder, which was uncovered in Babylon in the 1800s. This is a replica of it. I'll pass this around. It's quite heavy. I started taking my bricks with me as I went to these trips, and one day at TSA in Chattanooga, I was stopped. I was stopped, by the way. They took that out of the wrap, bubble wrap as well. And she asked me, "What is it?" I says, "Well, it's a Babylonian inscription." "Oh, cool!" Everybody gathered around. I didn't have the same experience with the Babylonian brick. I made the mistake of calling it a brick, and this is what the TSA officer said to me. He says, "That can be used as a bludgeoning device." I said, "Sir, with all due respect, I'm an archaeologist. I would never use it as a bludgeoning device. It is my task to take care of that artifact and not have any." I said, "That's an ancient artifact, by the way, from Babylon." "Oh, really? Oh, that's really cool." Before I knew it, there were 10 of them gathered around this artifact. And I was ushered to the plane with the artifact, luckily. But I don't take it with me anymore. So here we have them going underneath the city wall, and it's very interesting because the book of Isaiah talks a little bit about this. October 12, 539 BC, the book of Isaiah predicts this. It says, "I am the Lord who says to the deep, be dry and I will dry up your rivers, who says of Cyrus, he is my shepherd and shall perform my pleasure, all my pleasure." By the way, Cyrus is mentioned here in the book of Isaiah. The book of Isaiah is an 8th century book. It's written about 150 years, at least, before this event took place. Cyrus is named by name as the person that would conquer Babylon. Now, of course, the critics don't like this, so what do? They've redated the book of Isaiah so that it happened after the event. "Saying to Jerusalem, you shall be built, and to the temple your foundation shall be laid." It was Cyrus, remember, that ordered the Israelites to go back to Jerusalem and allowed them to begin that process. Here's the original Cyrus cylinder in the museum there at the British Museum in London. Isaiah 45 verse 1 says, "Thus says the Lord to his anointed." By the way, the word "his anointed" there, you know what that word is. It's Mashiach. It's Messiah. Okay, to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have held. Why? To subdue nations before him and to loose the armor of kings. Let me tell you something today, friends. We need to pray for the leaders of this world, because God can use the leaders of this world. Whether they're believers, like Nebuchadnezzar eventually became, or whether they are unbelievers, like Cyrus, he can still use the leaders of the world precisely as they. Alexander the Great, of course, tried to rebuild Babylon, but he failed in doing so. Alexander, that was Hannibal. I know Hannibal had elephants. I'm not sure about Alexander. He planned to rebuild the temple tower at Babylon and make the city a provincial capital. But we know what happened to Alexander, right? He died in a drunken stupor at the end of in a party in Babylon that he had for a number of days. And he was so out of it, he could no longer name a successor. And it was divided among his four generals, Lysimachus, Cassander, Ptolemy, and Seleucus. And so, again, the prophecy of the horn in Daniel chapter 8 coming down and replaced by four other conspicuous horns that came up was graphically fulfilled. Isaiah 13 says this, Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It will never be inhabited, nor will it be settled from generation to generation, nor will the Arabians pitch tents there, nor will shepherds make their sheepfolds there. But wild beasts of the desert will lie there, and their houses will be filled with full of owls. Jeremiah says, Babylon shall become a heap, a dwelling place for jackals, an astonishment, a hissing without an inhabitant. And this is the amazing thing that Tom Mary told me. He says, as I was sleeping there night after night during those 6 months, in 2003, he says, what did I hear coming from the ancient city of Babylon? The sounds of olives, owls hooting at night and the sounds of jackals howling. And as I read these passages, as I was laying there in my bunk, he says, I had chills going up and down my back because prophecy was being fulfilled. And what did Saddam Hussein do? He tried to rebuild it, but he was not able. The Bible's accuracy again and again. Babylon eventually came to be told. Today it is still destroyed. And while there are visitors that go there and excavate there, it is on. Daniel 4 doesn't end with Nebuchadnezzar's famous proclamation that he built the city of Babylon. Of course, right after that, what happens? The king spoke, saying, is this not great Babylon that I built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty? While the word was still in the king's mouth, a voice fell from heaven. King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you, and they shall drive you from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and they shall make you eat grass like oxen, and 7 times or 7 years will pass over you, until you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses. We don't know exactly what Nebuchadnezzar had. Some people think it might be something like lycanthropic insanity, where a person actually thinks they're an animal and behaves like an animal. We don't know. But for 7 years, Nebuchadnezzar in this state, the Bible tells us. But then, eventually, he writes, at the same time, my reason returned to me. My counselors and nobles resorted to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor. And those who walk in pride, people sometimes ask me, Dr. Hazel, what would be the most amazing about the Ark of the Covenant? And while that would be exciting, well, that would probably be on the top. I haven't gone looking for it. I'm kind of afraid because the last person that touched it didn't do so well. But I don't think God's glory is still with the Ark. But I would love to find the edict that really is Daniel chapter 4. It's really an edict that he sends out to his kingdom and tells, find a tablet with that on it. That. Or to find the tablet that Xerxes or Ahasuerus wrote, allowing the Jews to defend themselves after Haman is killed and after Mordecai becomes a Christian, that and Mordecai actually write edict. That would be amazing to find with Mordecai. Okay, I can go on and on. Never mind. It's interesting the parallels between these two men. Both of them seeking to become glorious in the world's eyes, both of them. I am not God, and I'm not the judge, but I personally believe I'm going to see Nebuchadnezzar. If I read carefully enough in these passages, I think that finally, after Daniel chapter 2 by Daniel chapter 4, God worked through a prophet named Daniel and we reached Nebuchadnezzar. How is it with us today, 21st century? I'm sure you know of people that need to hear the gospel message and accept Jesus Christ into their lives. And how do you apply this to yourself personally? How do I apply it to myself personally? Do I have a temptation to be filled with pride? I'm an academic. And in academics, academic pride is something that everybody... But today I want to tell you that there's nothing more humbling and more wonderful than serving a God who is great and who is high and lifted up. And when you catch a glimpse of that God and you catch a glimpse of his loving kindness in sending his son to this earth, you have the reaction of Isaiah in chapter 6. Woe is me,
for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. And you realize, as the seraphim flies to Isaiah and places that burning coal upon his lips, and he experiences the cleansing power from the heavenly sanctuary in his life, you can realize that God's mercy and his grace is powerful. And Isaiah proclaims a message during the rest of his life, a message that ends not well for him physically, but it is a message that wins souls to the kingdom. It's a message that wins a king named Hezekiah to pray a prayer that delivers a city and prepares a people for the new Jerusalem. Let's bow our heads for prayer. Heavenly Father, what a privilege it is to see these ancient artifacts and these ancient relics. We don't worship the relics, we worship a God who works with feeble human beings to accomplish his goal if only they humble themselves and ask to be used by him. And Lord, today we want to recommit our lives to you in this place. Help us to catch that glimpse of you that not only will change us for eternity, but make us the change agents you want us to be for this time and place here where we are, so that we can be used by the Holy Spirit like Daniel and his friends were used in powerful places, but maybe even in humble places. Whatever it is that you want us to do, Lord, you know where you can use us most. We ask, Lord, for that power of your Holy Spirit. It's the thing that we need most in the time in which we live. May you pour out your Spirit on us today so that we can see you coming in the clouds of glory soon. We thank you in the precious name of Jesus. Amen.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.